You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Before I air this week's interview, I want to again mention that Write the Book returns to the airwaves in Burlington at 3 p.m. on February 6th. It's again a Monday, which has always been our broadcast day. We will be broadcasting from the new WBTV studios on your radio at 99.3. Can't wait. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Maggie Cast, author of A Free Unsullied Land, published in 2015 by Fomite Press. Maggie Cast is also the author of The Crack Between the Worlds, a dancer's memoir of loss, faith, and family, published by Wipf and Stock. She received an MFA in writing from Vermont College of Fine Arts and has published fiction in The Sun, Nimrod, Rosebud, Paper Street, and others. A chapter of her memoir, published in ACM, another Chicago magazine, won a literary award from the Illinois Arts Council and a Pushcart nomination. A story published in Rosebud and judged by Ursula Le Guin won an honorable mention in their fantasy fiction contest. Her essays have appeared in America, Image, Writer's Chronicle, and elsewhere. A Free Unsullied Land is Maggie Cast's first novel. Here's the publisher's summary of the book. 19-year-old Henriette Greenberg takes her first steps away from an abusive home on the dance floor of a Chicago jazz dive in Prohibition-era Chicago and is enraptured by this new music. Struggling to escape a mother who doesn't like girls and a father who likes young women all too well, she submerges herself in bad sex and political action. She meets and falls in love with Dilly Branigan, a graduate student in anthropology. Ignoring his warnings, she travels to Scottsboro, Alabama, to protest the unfair conviction of 9 young black men accused of rape. She adopts Dilly's work as her own. A powerful funeral ritual gives her hope of rewriting her family's story, but tempts her to violate an Apache taboo, endangering her life, her love, and her longed-for escape from home. I spoke with Maggie Cast in December. Later on the day that we spoke, I saw an announcement that A Free Unsullied Land had won the WordWrite Book Award. So congratulations to Maggie for that. Our interview begins with Maggie reading from the novel. In this scene, Henriette has traveled to Scottsboro, Alabama, to protest the unfair conviction of those 9 young black men accused of rape.
A low rumble, like distant thunder, as the people around Henriette started muttering, accosting each other. "How long they expect us to wait?" A wizened farmer with a cane pressed his lips into a grim line, his eyes popping out like a frog's. "We've been patient. We waited for the law, the jury, the judge, the trial." A thin man with mustache yellow from tobacco juice hawked and spit, and Henriette turned away. "No more waiting," people around them took up the cry. "Enough waiting, no more." They began to stamp their feet. Then, in time, chanting, "We've been patient, we won't wait. Death to the brutes whose crime we hate." Bystanders joined the crowd, and all began to march around the square towards the group near Maurer, chants competing. Stuck among hostile people, Henriette tried to worm and wiggle her way through the crowd, sure she would be safer close to Maurer. Voices yelled, "Go home! Get back! Get out!" growing louder, and the dense crowd pressed forward until she could barely stay on her feet. Pinned, she heard shouts and screams just ahead. She ducked down and squirmed between flailing limbs, until she was among sympathizers, where a heavy woman with a smell like orange put an arm around her. "Here, honey," said the woman, "you stay with me," and they joined in the ILD chant. The crowd surged back and forth like a monster with a will of its own, and Henriette was caught within it, forced to stagger and clutch at strangers. Grasping at shoulders, belts, and skirt hems, she and the woman went down and hit the ground hard, the woman on top, cement and grit. Wedged between street and heavy, pounding flesh, Henriette's head banged on the ground and dust filled her mouth. She gasped, coughed, sputtered, and spit. Unable to rise, she tried to curl and cover her head as people trod on her and fell over her. Curses. Cement cold on her cheek despite the hot day. A mewling infant cried. It was she. Someone yanked Henriette's hands behind her back, locking them together, then hoisted her to her feet. Blood ran down her forehead, but she couldn't reach up to wipe it away. Rough fingers dug into the tendons of her neck. "You're under arrest," said a big, unshaven man in T-shirt and work pants, badge on his belt next to a holstered gun. He marched her over to a van and shoved her into the back with several others. Rumble and bump. Tears running down her face, fear that her bowels would let go, pounding in her head, ache in her shoulders. The woman who'd protected her had disappeared. Where were parents, friends, the ordinary people she'd always thought were good at heart? The scrapes on her knees and the cut on her forehead burned, and blood dripped into her left eye. She twisted her head to try to wipe it off, but couldn't even reach a shoulder. Dropping her head to her knee, she managed to smear a bloody stain on her skirt, but her shoulders screamed at the motion. Raising her head, she looked around. 5 or 6 white men were sitting with her on the benches that lined the van, lit by a bare bulb overhead. Probably not protesters, more likely men who rode with the Klan by night. Any one of them could be a hate-filled Lucky, thinking of her as meat and ready to jump on her. If they realized why she was here, thank God they were as cuffed as she. They might have gotten rough and rowdy in the square, but the law would likely slap their hands and let them go. Maybe the coppers were the real criminals, as she'd often thought, and now she was at their mercy. Her teeth began to chatter, and the trembling spread to her whole body. If she were ever to get out of here, she'd have to think fast, minute by minute. Reality stared her hard in the face. No moths, no veil. White men in plain clothes unloaded the van and marched the prisoners into a small office, where a man in a green visored hat sat behind a wooden desk. A sign read, "Jackson County Sheriff." The sheriff cleared his throat and spat in a cuspidor by his desk, and Henriette wished for the neatly dressed National Guard with their clean, tan uniforms. "What's this ragtag crew?" asked the sheriff. "Loitering," said the cop who'd brought them in. "Disorderly conduct, actually brawling." The sheriff proceeded to book each of them, holding up the pen for those who couldn't write. They touched it, and he noted their names in a big book, then made their big X mark beside it. When he came to Henriette, he paused, then gave her the pen to sign her name. "You're too young to be in this kind of trouble," he said. "In future, stay home." "All I did was pass out leaflets," said Henriette, trying to keep the chatter out of her voice. "Asking for a new trial." "Let's see one of them leaflets," said the sheriff. She pulled one out and gave it to him, fearing this was a mistake. He looked at the image and laughed loud and long, showing it around to his deputies. "How is a little girl like you going to smash any noose?" he asked, miming a rope around her neck and pretending to yank on it. His face grew serious, and he leaned in, smells of lunch in her face. "You interfere with the way we do things, and you'll be in trouble like you cannot conceive. I saved the prisoners from the mob one time, but I'm not going to save you and your pals from the people of this town. You'll get what's coming to you."
Wonderful. Thanks for reading that. I wanted to just ask, you know, this scene that takes place in Alabama, and particularly that moment where she says, "Where are the ordinary people that she thought were good at heart?" It reminds me a lot of how people are feeling today with so much divisiveness, so much on either side of this political divide, and people wondering, where are the good people? I thought all these people were good people, but we don't like each other very much anymore. Are you getting a lot of that reaction to scenes in this book?
I have had, readings as recently as a week or two ago. I think, first of all, I've never read that scene.
Okay.
And so people, I have had some of the events that I've done have been called forging ahead or falling behind. Yeah. And that was before the election. But the question was, are we doing better? Because we've in Chicago, as I'm sure you know, we've had a huge amount of police brutality. So those meetings were arranged around. I did read some of the Scottsboro scene of those, and we talked about whether we're making progress or not in terms of racial equality and understanding that Black Lives Matter and so on.
Yeah.
So yes, in that sense, with those events, we definitely did address those issues.
Okay.
Though not so much specifically in terms of the election, just because it only just happened.
Right. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about how the book came into being, A Free Unsullied Land, published by Fomite Press. I did read about your mother's passing in 2005 and that you had discovered a number of letters of hers that impacted your work. I wonder if you can tell this story or however you would like to explain to us how the book came to be.
Well, the novel takes place in the time of my parents. That's the 1930s, which was the period of the Depression, and together with that, a huge amount of artistic and political and sexual ferment. Mm-hmm. If you thought the 60s were revolutionary, take a look at the 30s. Then my mother died, actually, in 2003, and her letter came to me. And in those letters, I discovered this very sassy, bright person who was very different from the sort of respectable, responsible mother that I knew. Although she was still very bright, but she wasn't quite as risk-taking. She wasn't quite as ebullient. And particularly, she liked, talking back to professors and things like that as a student. And so I wanted to bring that character to life. I wanted to give her a chance to have a new life on the page, a life that she probably gave up to have me and so on.
So Henriette Greenberg, the main character of the book, is sort of, at least her starting point was based on your mother, although it's not your mother. I read that too.
Yes, it definitely is not my mother. It uses many of the details of her life, for instance, being a student at the University of Chicago, coming from Oak Park, having a somewhat troubled home life. Those things are all real. But the adventures that I take her on are things that she never did and never would have wanted to do. She did not go to Scottsboro, although she certainly sympathized with that case, but she did not go there, and she did not have many of the relationships that are in the book and so on.
Right. Okay. Now, I should mention that the very opening of the book, the very first scenes, are actually taking place during the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti. And I thought that was a very interesting way for you to set up the book, but also Henriette Greenberg's early influences and her reaction to these executions. How did you decide to include those in the beginning of the book?
Well, as I'm sure you know from your own experience, editing is a long and torturous process. So the beginning of the book for a long time was a scene that is in there in very truncated form much later, which was this dinner where one of her brothers throws pudding across the table.
Oh, yeah.
So that got deferred. And, when Mark Estrin of Fomite accepted this book, he wanted much more political material added. So that was a whole major revision. And in that process, I wrote that opening about Sacco and Vanzetti, seen through the eyes of Henriette Greenberg.
Yeah.
That was how that happened. It was, and then I put in a lot more historical material.
It was very, very effective. I thought it was a great way to open the book. Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say, this really has to do with my whole feeling about how fact and fiction work together, because I wanted to put more historical material in there, but I was so afraid of reducing it to seeming like these things were stuck in, losing the narrative flow,
Yeah.
But Mark was convinced that I could do it and it would improve the novel. It mm-hmm. would make it more relevant, make it be more about things that mattered. And I think it improved it greatly. But I didn't have the nerve to do it. I could just hear all the members of my writing group saying, oh, that sounds essayistic or something.
It's funny because a lot of publishers, you'd be concerned about being too political. But with Mark, you definitely want to be political.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about the time period, the late 20s and early 30s in Chicago. So the setting and the time period. Did you have a lot to go on just having been raised by your mother or by your parents? Did you know a lot about that time period anyway? Did you have to do a lot of research?
I did an enormous amount of research, although there are some things that came or were suggested, you know, by things that I knew from my parents. But in order to get it right, I wanted, even from the beginning, I wanted all the historical part that dealt with actual people or mm-hmm. actual events. I wanted it to be accurate. And so I did an enormous amount of research, and I really enjoyed that a lot. And I found wonderful things. There's a library in New York connected with NYU that is politically oriented, and that's where I found Theodore Dreiser's speech about the Scottsboro case. And I actually took from that, although I summarized and edited it a lot, but still I took from I got an actual photostatic copy of it from that library.
Yeah.
I loved having those pieces of evidence. You know, I like evidence, but I also like evidence that takes off into areas that you can only reach by the imagination.
Now, I suspect that part of researching this time period would have brought you to new narrative decisions, new plot points even. Was that kind of fun to discover things that you suddenly thought, oh, this is going to be part of what happens in this book?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, I read about Scottsboro and then I thought, hey, maybe she goes there, you know.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the Apache stuff. I mean, my mother did do research with the Mescalero Apache, but she didn't have any of those experiences of the funeral. And looking into Apache funeral practice, I found many people, like in my writing group, were appalled. They couldn't imagine a culture where you would avoid the dead and you wouldn't really memorialize them.
Mm.
I mean, that's so counter to their own experience. They almost didn't believe it, but I read it, so...
So one part of this that I really enjoyed was the jazz scene in Chicago at this time period. And it's very exciting for Henriette. And one of her early jazz experiences is to see Louis Armstrong perform. Mm-hmm. So I have two questions about this. First is about the character development of Henriette. There's a moment where Louis Armstrong sings, "I double dare you to kiss me, and then I double dare you to kiss me again, hot mama." And just hear him doing that. And Henriette rolls the last two words around in her mouth, giving them Satchmo's offbeat inflection, hot mama. And then you write, "She licked her lips, tasting the person she'd like to be." I loved that line. I felt like that was so important, a real moment of who she's deciding, you know, to be, and how she's coming into herself, coming into her own. So that was great. That was really, it felt important to me. But I also was curious about your own introduction to jazz and if there was an exciting introduction for yourself like this.
I don't think so. Now, jazz to me was my mother, because she really liked jazz and she had these old records and so on. And
right.
My parents actually went to college with Catherine Dunham, who was studying anthropology, but was also a dancer and African-American and very much involved in the African-American arts scene. But my mother, even in high school, was enamored of the poets of the Harlem Renaissance. So this is a piece of actual family evidence. She wrote her graduating high school essay on the Harlem poets of the Harlem Renaissance.
That's interesting.
Did I have that experience? No, I didn't really. I mean, I like jazz, meaning specifically, you know, the jazz of that period, because I heard it at home all the time. But my awakening was really in other areas. You know, I danced at that age, you know, and that was my first career. So my stories would be more about that kind of thing.
Now, I read, I'm pretty sure on the back of the book, I read a quote, yeah, from Rose Ellen Brown. Is she in your writing group by any chance? She would be an awesome member of a writing group. Oh, my goodness.
They're all pretty awesome. I have to tell you, they're really good.
Oh, that's great. Well, so I did interview Rose Ellen at one point a long time ago when she went to Vermont College as a visiting.
I remember when that was, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I asked her this question, and I'm going to ask you this question too. Can you talk a little bit about writing about race and if this presented any particular challenges for you as a white woman to write about race and how you approached it?
Well, you know, this comes back to my own personal experience. I grew up in an interracial environment, even though that was not so common in the 50s. But my father was Truman's advisor on race relations.
Oh.
And we always had African-American friends. My parents started the Georgetown Day School, which was the first interracial school in D.C. When I went to public school, high school, it was segregated. But, you know, that was not my background. So I always had friends. And so it did not feel to me like cultural appropriation. I'm making finger quotes around that. Actually, I'm guilty of much more cultural appropriation now because I've been working on a novella that involves the Hmong, and I've never known any Hmong people. And I've definitely read all the controversy, you know, with Lionel Shriver and the following. And in fact, my writing group circulated all the responses to that, and they were very interesting, pro and con. So I don't think, you know, the only place where race affected how I was going to write it was I had a really wonderful novel workshop with Kevin McElvoy, who teaches at Warren Wilson. And that was really near the end. And he wanted me to deepen and exaggerate the novel in many ways. I should maybe exaggerate is the wrong word. Make it funnier and sadder, he said. And then he said that I should have one really evil character, and he wanted it to be the African-American man. And my response to that is, one evil character is fine. It'll be Lucky. That was a boyfriend of Henriette's. But I'm not going to take the one African-American character and have him be the one evil person. No way. I just think that would be a stupid move.
Yeah.
So,
what did he think of that?
Oh, I didn't tell him that.
You're just saying in your mind you were thinking this.
I was only there for, it was a weekend. It's an intensive weekend where he reads the entire thing in advance.
Wow.
A complete manuscript. Then gives you notes on it and then spends an hour talking to you about it. But within that hour, I wouldn't decide what I was going to do, you know.
No, I didn't get it. Okay.
So I just took home his suggestions and worked with them over time.
Okay. You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the author Maggie Cast. Do you like the podcast? That's great. If so, I would ask that you please go to iTunes and rate or review it. And don't forget to tell some friends. Thank you, and keep listening. Is Chicago a fun place to be a writer? Do you have a huge writing scene? Are you in Chicago?
Yeah, I'm in Chicago. We have a huge live lit scene, which is really great, and it has such variety. And in addition to that, I'm now on the board of a dance and performing arts center called Lynx Hall, and although most of what they do is more like theater, they just had a series called Poets Theater, and I discovered a whole new writer and performer and way of performing literature that I found extremely beautiful. It's already well known, and I don't think that these, the Poets Theater and the Live Lit people, I don't even know if they even know each other exists. I mean, we tend to be in such isolated communities, but I did see one piece that was marvelous, and this was a festival they culled from all over the country. In fact, this one guy that I particularly admired, Wayne. No. Alex Waterman lives in Brussels. He just came to do this particular thing. Do you know the work of Robert Ashley? I never heard of him, but he did a choral performance of work by Robert Ashley that was spectacular.
All right, great. One thing that I absolutely loved in this book was the vocabulary of the times, which is something that if it's infused well and woven into a narrative organically, it's just so much fun, which you did. A few of the words that you used, which I won't tell what the associations are because I don't want to give anything away, but the word snazzy, the word hitched, they refer to their friends as the Klan. And then at some point, somebody says, signed, sealed, and delivered, you know, and it was like, it was so much fun. It's just so unique to that time period. And you know that it was completely accurate and that this is how people talked. And it was fun to come across that. Did that come to you from your mother's letters, or was that not the way that she spoke and that it was more about your research?
Well, there's multiple sources for that. One of them is my own age, you know, because words like snazzy and hitched are words that I might use myself. And of course, my children would probably roar with laughter. So that's part of it. Part of it was research. There's wonderful websites with all kinds of language of various decades. And then part of it was Mark, the editor at Fomite, because he said, the language is not specific enough. And so then I went back and put a whole lot in there, you know, that was stuff that I didn't know. Oh, well, then at that point, when I was editing in response to Mark, I also read a whole bunch of things I hadn't read, novels of the period. And some of them, the language was appropriate for me to use. And some of them, it was so bizarre. It was totally, totally not appropriate.
Oh.
So that was really interesting. Like, for instance, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I mean, you get a complete sense of total racial prejudice and anti-Semitism inside of two pages.
Yeah.
And that includes a lot of the language. The other one, it's been a while since I did this, so I won't be able to remember right away, but there's one other very famous novel where the main character, it's by Sinclair Lewis, is it? I don't know. The main character is a salesman, and it's all the language of selling.
Oh.
And my characters were not going to speak that, you know.
Right.
So some of it I adopted, and then some of it I rejected.
Great. There are scenes with a therapist. Henriette goes to a therapist, which was interesting to me. I was trying to remember anything I might have known about what the times were like as far as psychotherapy goes. I'm sure that Freud was influencing people to be more open to thinking about their thoughts, thinking about their thoughts. But was psychotherapy widely accepted in this time? And then in the 50s, perhaps it became not acceptable and more shameful. I feel like in the 50s, psychotherapy, people didn't want to admit to going to talk to a shrink.
Well, I don't know that she would have. I don't know how many people she would have talked to about that. I doubt that. I doubt that she would have told her mother. And I think she does have some. Does she mention it to Dilly? I can't remember now.
I think she does. I think she does. I think he knows she's going.
Oh, of course. In the beginning, yes, she tells him he needs to be analyzed, and he says, "Not me," you know.
Right.
No, of course. So for her, it was a matter. First of all, she's a little bit brittle. About so that she can speak about things that she doesn't really feel. You know, that's she says that early on, I think, that she can say anything, but she can't feel anything, or can't feel everything. She can say everything, but she can't feel anything. Anyhow, so she might say something like, well, I'm in psychotherapy, you know, and she would have said analysis because this was a high prestige thing for her, you know, and her brother being in training as an analyst, and she really looked up to him a lot, and he was her favorite brother. So she would be very proud of that. But then I don't think she would go run around telling all her girlfriends about that or something. But she might even do that because she would be proud that she was on the in, that she was considered worthy of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She'd been accepted as an analysand, you know.
Right. There's this great line in the therapy session, and I'll just quickly recap it. It's toward the end of the book, and she's talking to the therapist, and there's this beautiful fish tank in the therapist's office, and the fish are swimming, and she's watching them, and she describes them as blissfully ignorant of what goes on in this room. And I loved that. I laughed out loud. It was just like this great moment to point out the various universes that coexist, you know, and here's this room where all of this deep-seated angst comes out, and the fish don't have a clue. It was just, I don't know, it was funny.
That was actually from my own experience, because when I was in therapy, there was a fish tank, you know, so I just, it definitely struck me that way.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so let's talk about, I was curious about your creative decision to make Henriette's Jewish family become Unitarians. I wondered if that was based on your family or if it was some sort of historical precedent that you read about, that this was a popular thing to do at that time period, or did you just want to convey something very specific about the characters and who they were?
Well, the whole attitude towards Judaism, you know, for there are a lot of Jews who, rather than being proud of being Jewish, choose to reject it. My idea of why that person, why Henriette's mother rejected it, is because she was not respected as a woman in Judaism. She wasn't counted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, specifically, she couldn't be counted as part of a minyan.
Right.
And that had a big effect on Henriette because it was her mother also didn't respect herself as a woman. So Henriette also didn't respect herself as a woman. You know, she was what's called male identified, you know, that,
yeah,
in some stage of feminism. And all of that is based on my mother's family. I mean, they were very active Unitarians, and there was a big, you know, that was a big Unitarian church, still is there in Oak Park. And it was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, and his uncle, Jenkin Lloyd Jones, was the pastor. So that's all historical. And they were very active in that. My grandmother, my mother's mother, was very active in supporting Lincoln Center, which was the social service outreach. So that interest in, you know, supporting the African-American community goes way back. And also, you know, Julius Rosenwald, there's a movie about him now, which I haven't seen yet, but apparently it supports that a lot. Julius Rosenwald, who was the founder of Sears, was did a lot for African American education. So all of that goes way back, which makes it affects also how I write about African American people.
It was very interesting. I enjoyed reading about that. And actually, now that you've just said this, we should just explain that a minyan is the minimal number of people required to have a Jewish service. And I'm trying to remember what that number is. Do you remember?
10 or 12, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So that's a very interesting point that women wouldn't have been counted toward the minyan. Let's talk about the book's title, A Free Unsullied Land. Was this a title that you found and came up with, or did Mark help you with that?
I wanted to call it I Never Knew You Had a Girl, which reflects the mother's attitude. Well, it was something that was said to the mother, but it reveals the fact that she never talked about her daughter. She only talked about her sons.
Yes.
That's a piece of dialogue that is still in there. But Mark didn't like it. He said he did not like lines of dialogue as titles. So I just went through the book and picked out about 10 different things. And he chose that one. But I really liked his rationale for that. He said it really combines the idea of the world being maybe could become a better place than it was then, but also it would be the kind of freedom that Henriette wanted for herself and may or may not have achieved at the end.
And interesting, you know, the cover art, I think, lends itself to thinking about the second interpretation of that. I think the word land ties really neatly into patriotism and improving our own country. And I think that's just because, you know, maybe the patriotic songs use the word, you know, this land is your land. So the title sort of brings that first thing out maybe more strongly. And then the cover art makes us think about that second thing, which is Henriette's own freedoms. And so let's just describe the cover. And if you can give a little background on the artist or where you found this piece.
Well, Mark found it. August Burns is the painter. It's a painting, a painting that's reproduced. And Mark knew her. She's in Burlington, as you probably know. He found it and really liked it. And he specifically said the same thing you said. He said it includes the idea of the title that I had originally planned. So it puts the two things together. And the cover has done really well for the book. I've gotten really good responses to it.
It's a lovely cover. It's a hanger hanging on a nail on a very plain background, and it looks sort of like a plain white wall. And hanging off of the hanger is a slip, a sleeveless slip with a little bit of lace on the edges. It's a lovely cover. Okay, now you already mentioned the mother in the book. Henriette's mother prefers boys to girls, and she isn't a very confident person. She's not always a very kind person. Maybe this is personal and I should just not, but was your grandmother like this toward your mother?
Yeah, she was very, very stern, very ironclad, a very strong person, you know, very big advocate of women's rights, belonged to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, was befriended Jane Addams and W.E.B. Du Bois. I actually have a photograph endorsed to my grandmother with her maiden name from W.E.B. Du Bois. So she was very interested in, you know, in helping people and in service and so on, as well as in women's rights, but not very affectionate.
Okay, but that's a little bit different than this mother. It doesn't sound like your real grandmother preferred boys necessarily, or?
Well, you know, this has to do with self-hatred, you know? I mean, she attended the University of Chicago for a few years, but didn't finish because it was, you know, too impossible for a woman at that time to stay in school in that way. So she was sad about being a woman, and that is not very reinforcing for daughters.
Okay. That makes sense. Do you mind if I read a paragraph and then we can talk about it a little bit? Okay. This is the opening paragraph from chapter 13. As Henriette's study of Apache linguistics deepened, she became fascinated with the ways that words could mean, suggest, or deceive, weaken or strengthen a person, transmit a curse or a blessing. Apparently, the words that she tossed in the air like ping pong balls carried weight for others, like sticks and stones. Her professor, Ivar Inga Britson, a colleague of Isidore Daniels, had studied and transcribed the Chiricahua Apache Warpath language, a special language learned by adolescent novices as part of their training for raids and battles. The language empowered and protected the speaker the way signing solidarity had strengthened her in New York. That jumped out at me. I think it jumped out at me a little bit because language became important to me personally when I learned a second one. So I'm just curious if you had a moment like that. Is there a moment where you were studying a second language, or is there another influence that reminds you of yourself in hearing about her reaction to the Apache language and how it maybe influenced your work to become a writer?
Well, words and language always played a big part in my life because my mother talked to me from the time I was born, and really often substituted talking for other forms of expression that might make more sense to an infant or to a child. So I was always verbal. But you know, in opposition to that, I started dancing when I was six and mm-hmm. kept on doing it until I was over 60. You know, so then that was my main thing. So I would say that, you know, writing becoming important to me in later life really happened after my husband died. And I think it really was a way of having someone to talk to, you know, mm-hmm. a way of sharing, you know, all these things that I wanted to express. And then, of course, I got really interested in making it work as a thing, meaning making an object, making not a book, but making a story or a piece of work. So it became just as interesting as making a dance. You know, it's making something. Yeah. You know?
And expressing yourself in a creative way.
Right.
Yeah. So have you ever studied a second language?
I do study languages like mad. I've studied German as a child, and then I was married to an Austrian, so we spoke German so that the kids couldn't understand what we were saying. So German is my best language, though not one that I have studied the longest in the sense of becoming, you know, grammatical and so on. But I'm most fluent in it. Then I studied Spanish for a long time, and I'm least fluent in that. I don't know. I can never understand spoken Spanish. I can read it, but you know, it goes by so fast.
That's true.
And then I've been studying French more recently, and you know, I'm just an intermediate level student. And so yeah, I'm definitely into languages, and I'm not going to tackle anymore. I have a Russian daughter-in-law, and I'm not going to try to learn Russian. And my Russian granddaughter speaks Russian, English, and German, so she can translate for all of us. She's only 3 and a half, but she's very skilled.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, now I was going to mention not all of Henriette's decisions feel like the right moves. She makes mistakes,
indeed,
which to me made her a very real character. But I also was interested, one of the reviews of your book, I can't remember if it was one of the blurbs on the book or if it was like a Goodreads review. It was a very positive comment about the book, but it talked about how sometimes readers expect heroism. And that struck me. Have you had any reactions from readers who were disappointed by Henriette not making the right decisions that might harm her or not lead her down the right path? Has anyone reacted that way?
Oh yes, I think you know a lot of responders just didn't feel sympathy with her. Didn't feel like they felt like you know if she couldn't figure things out for herself, they weren't going to figure them out for her. You know, and I've had a lot of negative criticism. One said that there was too much sex in it, and I hope that would help it sell. You know, so it's been a matter of taste. Some people like to read about people that are struggling in different ways, and some people would rather that everything came out great at the end.
Well, it's interesting. I do think that, and I remember, who did I hear make a comment about this? I think it was Antonia Nelson was asked once about happy endings or kind of sunny narratives. And I loved her answer, which was, you know, it's all well and good that sometimes literature is an escape for people. But I think for me and for others who appreciate the kind of work that where it isn't an escape, it makes you feel like you're a part of something to read about people that actually have flaws and make mistakes and maybe don't always have the, you know, everything tied up with a bow and the happy ending. And I'm not saying your book does or doesn't have a happy ending. I'm just saying that she said that, and that was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Do you plan your narrative ahead of time, or do you sort of let it arise organically as you work?
I let it arise, and it changes a lot usually in the course of what I'm doing. And the beginning is likely to get chopped off. You know, I murder my darlings if I can. I really feel like I have to keep it open-ended, and see where it goes.
Yeah. Okay. Did that make it take longer to write?
It doesn't take me a long time to put words down on the page, but I feel like I write much better if I write slower. And I always just revise a whole huge amount. I can't really evaluate what I've written till I look at it the next day, and then I see it's all wrong and they start over again, you know. Each of my books has taken about the same amount of time, I guess. I started A Free Unsullied Land in 2009 when my first book came out, and it was published in 2016, so that's, 7 years? Mm-hmm. About the same for the other one, too. It was about a year after I finished VCFA, Vermont College of Fine Arts, that I started that memoir.
And you said that you started that memoir maybe as a way of having somebody to talk to after your husband died. When did your husband die?
In 88. No, I didn't start. I started the memoir much later than that, really. In the beginning, I was just writing anything, journaling, and then I read things like Annie Lamott's Bird by Bird and started doing timed writing. And, then I took some local classes, and that's when I did try out poetry then. And I do have a strong sense of, rhythm, if not too strong a one. So I was writing mainly stories in the beginning. So that's how I applied to Vermont, was with stories.
Okay. All right. We were talking a minute ago about endings. I wonder what to you, I don't want to give away anything about the ending of this book, but I'm just curious to have a more general conversation about what to you constitutes a satisfying ending to a novel.
I would say one that has an opening to future events. One that doesn't close down the story, mm-hmm. but rather opens it up. Maybe certain threads in the story might be closed, but maybe you discover some new ones right before the end so that you can think about what happened the next day.
Do you ever think about continuing Henriette's story?
Not at the moment. Who knows? I might. Right now I'm working on a novella, and I'm more interested in exploring this mixture of fact and fiction, which is sort of against the rules these days, but also very, very appealing to me and very important to me, actually, more than appealing.
Yeah, but I think experimentation is in fashion these days, and people are looking at things that were against the rules and saying, well, I'm going to do this anyway, whatever.
Yeah, Michael Chabon just did it with Moonglow.
Yeah.
And which I haven't read yet, but I very much look forward to. Well, I'm just working right now on an essay for, there's a little section called Stories We Love on Fiction Writers Review. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a very good online publication. And so I'm writing a piece about William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow, which combines autobiographical fiction and imagination. And he talks about it within the work also.
And you're hoping to submit it to them, or you already they know it's coming?
I'm in an editorial relationship with them. They haven't agreed to take it yet, but they've sent me back feedback twice and asked me to keep working on it.
And so
they're great. I must say it's just like having free writing classes,
That's wonderful. So I wonder, Maggie, if you can tell us what you might have read lately that you could recommend to listeners.
Well, because I'm working on a novella, I've just read about 14 or 15 novellas, and one of them obviously is So Long, See You Tomorrow. My favorites are mostly ones that I'm rereading, like Charles Baxter's Believers and Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach. Mm-hmm. And what I've really found is such an amazing variety of within that form that I'm not sure that the form means anything except just a certain length. But Ian McEwan, in a piece in the New Yorker, said that he thinks it's the ideal form. So anyhow, it's I'm just having fun with it. But in terms of longer works, in terms of the past year, the thing that I liked the best was My Name is Lucy Barton. Have you read that?
I have. That was wonderful.
It's so laid back, and it's so it's quiet, and you think, how can this ever be anything? And then it is so much.
It says so much about the characters that you're reading about, doesn't it? And she's just sitting there next to the hospital bed. It's so well done.
Or she is sitting in the hospital bed.
Right. The mother is next to the hospital bed, and right. That's not the whole scene and setting, but it just what is accomplished in that hospital room in a very static setting is very interesting. So yes. Well done. And I also love Ian McEwan. I haven't read his new one, Nutshell, I think it's called. Is that right?
I haven't read it.
Yeah, I love him too.
I loved Atonement, and I loved Saturday.
Yes, yeah. Oh my God, Saturday was amazing. It was so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, I have one last question for you for our conversation here. And you mentioned earlier that there were sex scenes in the book. You write both loving and difficult sex scenes that are more abusive or violent in this novel. I thought you did it very, very well. And so I wanted to ask you if you can offer advice for writers who might be listening about writing sex scenes, which I think some people find very intimidating. And some people, I guess, maybe don't. I don't know. I just thought maybe if you have any advice to offer.
Well, the advice that I would offer is the one that I was given. This was just in a workshop at AWP. I mean, it wasn't given personally to me, but there was a whole workshop on writing about sex. And one person said, you can't write about good sex. That's pornography. You can only write about bad sex.
No.
So I write mainly about bad sex, but all it was always in metaphoric terms, you know. You can't, as William Gass said in his book On Being Blue, which is about writing about sex, you can't describe sex the way you would eating a chicken wing, you know, bite by bite. But as far as good sex goes, yeah, it just has to be metaphorical. It has to be, you know. For instance, this is related, although not the exact same thing. I just read a piece, it was a New Yorker profile about the food critic Pete Wells, and they pointed out that he never talks about, never describes the dish itself. He names an ingredient and then gives an emotion. So that would be similar. You could go from ingredient to emotion with sex too, I imagine, if you didn't have too many literal ingredients.
I love that. That's great advice. Thank you so much. So I want to just mention that the book again is called A Free Unsullied Land. It's by Maggie Cast, and it's published by our own local Fomite Press. Maggie Cast, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed reading A Free Unsullied Land.
Well, thank you so much, Hala. It was great to talk to someone who had read the book so closely and had so many interesting comments and questions.
Well, thank you. That, again, was a conversation with the author Maggie Cast. You can learn more about her work at maggiecast.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by Maggie, who uses it when she teaches her workshops called Writing Your Family Story. Identify an object that was important in your family, either your family of origin or the family that you've since come to be a part of, and then contemplate that object, draw it if you want to, identify sensory details connected with it. How does it look? How does it smell? How does it feel? Is there a taste associated with it? Does it make any sound? And then put that object into a scene, into a place if you want to, and you could even draw that place. Then ask yourself, what happened in that place that made the object so important? Did it involve something contentious, nostalgic? Was there a fearful memory involved? Did the object perhaps get broken? Write as you remember. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I really do wish more people would do this. I'm usually pretty successful at asking authors if they might be on the show. So if you've got a favorite author or a favorite book or an obscure book that you really loved and didn't know about and want to share with others, please let me know. I'll try to get a hold of the author. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a wonderful week, and Happy New Year.